I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
Last week, retired Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, former top American commander in Iraq, had harsh words for the Bush administration. Sanchez is the latest in a string of military leaders who have criticized the policies and strategies of the Iraq war. He called the planning catastrophically flawed and unrealistically optimistic and said the civilian leaders were derelict in their duties. Sanchez was criticized in some quarters for not speaking up when he was still in uniform. Here's his response.
The last thing that you want is for currently serving general officers to stand up against our political leadership.
This is not the first time that there's been conflict and disagreement between the civilian and military leadership. The country's founders wrote the Constitution giving civilians control over military policy and making the president the commander-in-chief. Today on Radio Times, we talk about the tensions and balance of power between the military and civilian leaders in times of war. Both of our guests joining us by telephone. Richard Cohn is professor of history, peace, war, and defense at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's also former chief of history at the U.S. Air Force. And Richard Cohn, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning, Marty. Thanks for having me on the program.
You're very welcome. Also with us, Lawrence Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Before joining the center, he was senior fellow director for national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And from 1981 to 1985, he was assistant secretary of defense in the Reagan administration. And Lawrence Korb, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Nice to be with you again.
Richard Cohn, let me begin with you. Is it unusual to hear such pointed criticism from a retired lieutenant general like Ricardo Sanchez?
I think it's unusual in two ways, Marty. First of all, it's coming very early while the war is going on. And second of all, it's coming from the one of the early commanders of the war, who many believe himself bears some responsibility for the problems we are having in Iraq. And I also think that if you read his speech, the bitterness of it, the kind of blame assigned to virtually everybody, the press, the Congress, the NS, the National Security Council, the administration, Congress, I mean, it's just, one journalist characterized it as a scream of anger.
And did he take responsibility from that speech as you read it?
No, I don't think he did. I mean, it was the usual Washington term, you know, mistakes were made. But I don't think General Sanchez has ever owned up to his own failures in command, both in conceiving the problem and in coordinating with his civilian counterparts over in Iraq.
To you, Lawrence Korb, what did you make of Sanchez's comments last week?
Well, I think he is finally speaking out because what has happened, both General Sanchez and his successor, General Casey, have been pillared by a lot of people in the Republican Party, particularly Senators Graham and McCain, for being sort of, you know, the equivalent of General McClellan in the Civil War, and then, you know, glorifying General Petraeus as, you know, Grant. And so I think, you know, he was trying to say, hey, look, you know, I wasn't, you know, McClellan here. I was doing the best I can with the hand I was dealt, given, you know, all of the problems. Now, I agree with Dick. He may have gone a little overboard in some of the comments, but I found it a very healthy thing to say, because what has happened is, you know, in this, you know, mindless, needless, you know, senseless war that we're fighting, you know, at first we were, you know, blaming, you know, one group and then another, and then, you know, now we're blaming the Iraqis. Previous to that, we were blaming the generals, and nobody has blamed the real people, and as is the, you know, the administration that, you know, gave us, jiggered the intelligence to make it look like it was a threat, and then, you know, believed somebody like Chalabi that we'd be greeted as liberators.
To you, though, Lawrence Korb, you saying it's appropriate for him to have spoken out in public. Would it have been even more appropriate if he had privately criticized the Bush administration, or is there something important about these public statements?
Well, I think, you know, I hope, and we don't know that. I mean, in terms of when he was given the command, you know, did he make it clear, you know, whether he had enough troops or did not have enough troops? So, I mean, I think that we will know, history will, you know, tell us whether he, you know, told people, you know, his true, you know, true military feelings, or whether he relayed them to General Abizaid, the commander of the Central Command, who was his boss. Got to remember, General Sanchez was in a very difficult position. He was not a four-star general like Casey and Petraeus are, and Jerry Bremer, Ambassador Bremer, was really running the show pretty much back then, and making decisions like disbanding the Iraqi army, throwing all of the people who would ever work for the Ba'ath Party, you know, out of public office. And so Sanchez had no role in those decisions, which in my view is what really fueled the insurgency.
Go ahead, Richard.
You know, I agree with much of you, what you say, but I think that Sanchez had some responsibility to coordinate and get along with Ambassador Bremer. And after all, if, as Sanchez says, it was clear from the beginning that military power was not going to decide what happened in Iraq, he needed to be a little more integrated with what was going on. I'm told that Sanchez and Bremer hardly spoke, that they had personal differences. And I, on a different subject, I'm also bothered by a commander coming out while the war is still going on and while the administration he served is still in office, and issuing such a blanket and such a bitter set of criticisms against the administration. I don't disagree with the criticisms, but what I think it does is it poisons civil-military relations far into the future. Civilians are not going to trust the generals, and the generals are going to exercise this kind of power that derives from their political legitimacy and their prestige in American society, and it's not going to build good partnerships in the future when we have to use military force.
What then, and I think you've already almost answered this, but if a military leader such as Ricardo Sanchez disagrees then with the policy, the strategy for a war, we're talking obviously about the war in Iraq, what recourse does he have?
Well, I think that what his first recourse is to be absolutely brutally frank in private up his chain of command, and if necessary to make a pest of himself. He certainly has the legal right to go around the Secretary of Defense and take these issues directly to the President. That's written into the law. And if he doesn't get satisfaction, he simply has to soldier on. I don't believe that he can really resign. If all the military resigns, that's kind of a military revolt, and he can't abandon the American people or abandon his own troops in such a situation. His second recourse is the ability to testify before Congress. When Congress calls commanders to account, and a Congress should, and I admit that the Republican Congress never did, but when these men and women go to testify before Congress, they are always asked for their personal opinion on these issues, and they have to speak up forcefully and truthfully without breaking faith with the people they advise. They can't say, well, I told so-and-so this on such and such a date. They can't get into their actual advice, but they certainly can make their views known, and the American people will then find them out.
Well, let me turn to you, Lawrence Korb. I mean, if people in the military, obviously military leadership, is more than just troubled by policy coming from the civilian government, but actually disagrees with it, what can they do to try to either change someone's mind or put their criticism out for others to know?
Well, I think Dick is right, and we don't know what General Sanchez told, you know, Secretary Rumsfeld or the President. As far as I know, the President didn't have these video conferences like he has with General Petraeus, and in fact, it seems like the President was out of the loop. According to his own statements, he didn't even know that, Ambassador Bremer was going to disband the Iraqi military. At least that's what he claims. So we don't know if, in fact, that occurred, or whether he gave this advice to Secretary Rumsfeld, who passed it on to the president. And in testifying before the Congress, I think when the Congress asked him, yes, they have an obligation, because remember that the Congress, basically, it's Article 1 of the Constitution in terms of providing for the common defense, raising armies and navies, declaring war. So they have a right to know that. And so, again, I haven't checked all of General Sanchez's statements, but I don't recall him being up there as much as some of his successors were, and I think with, you know, General Abizaid probably did more of the testifying, and he was honest with the Congress. He said it was, you know, an insurgency, and Secretary Rumsfeld said, no, it's not an insurgency. He said, you know, yes, it is, and I assume that it was General Sanchez telling him this, and General Abizaid testified as early as July 2003 about that. But what General Sanchez didn't do, which I find terrible, is going on all these Sunday shows like General Pace did and General Myers did, basically, I don't know if they believed it, but telling us how good things were going in Iraq when, you know, the evidence did not seem to indicate that.
Let me just follow up one thing with you, Lawrence Corbin. I was thinking about Shinseki's testimony before Congress. So this was when he famously said he didn't believe there were going to be enough troops there, and said that the U.S. was going to need several hundred troops, I think either 400,000 or 500,000. He got roundly criticized. Was that appropriate for him to say that?
Well, I think it was appropriate for him to say that. And again, you got to remember that, I mean, it wasn't, you know, it was actually Senator Levin pressed him on the issue. He said it. And I think what was the worst thing about that is that Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz then said basically that he didn't know what he was talking about. Wolfowitz or Rumsfeld could have said, well, we got his opinion, we disagree with it. But they basically, you know, claimed that that this was, you know, completely wrong from a military point of view. I remember, you know, Wolfowitz saying, well, this is ridiculous that you would need more troops after an invasion than you would, you know, during the actual invasion, which ignores all of the, you know, the history that we know about, you know, in terms of occupations.
And we have a minute before our first break. Go ahead, Richard Cohn.
Well, I was going to say that one of the roots of this problem, I think Larry identifies it exactly, is that the president seemed to be, or at least from what we know, disassociated from what was going on, and delegated this war to Secretary Rumsfeld. And Mr. Rumsfeld was incredibly intimidating and abusive to his military, manipulated them, and I think prevented an honest dialogue. It was pretty clear to commanders down the line that what they could and couldn't say, even to him privately, I think. And so the civil-military relationship was in a sense, corrupted going into this war. I mean, as we went into this war, you had Shinseki being essentially kneecapped by his civilian superiors. They didn't even come to his retirement ceremony. The Secretary of the Army was fired. So they were poor relations from the very beginning.
And that's Richard Cohn, our guest, along with Lawrence Korb today on Radio Times, talking about the relationship between the civilians and military when it comes to war. And lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY is provided by Freelancers Union at Working Today, providing health insurance, dental insurance, professional networking, and more to freelancers in a variety of industries. More at freelancersunion.org.
The University of Pennsylvania Health System supports WHYY. Penn's team of heart specialists are committed to advancing the science of heart care, utilizing new technology to help pinpoint heart problems and treat them, from the most common to the most complex. They specialize in heart valve repairs, heart rhythm disorders, and heart transplant surgery. More information about heart care at the University of Pennsylvania Health System is online at pennhealth.com.
It's day six of a seven-day drive here at WHYY, our fall membership campaign. And on Radio Times, we're working off this challenge from the Independence Foundation. They want 800 listeners to Radio Times to become members, and then they will give WHYY an additional $10,000. What a deal. 1-888-345-9499. $50 makes you a basic member here. You can also pledge online at whyy.org. Make that call. Thanks so much.
The Atwater Camp Museum and eight area cultural organizations support WHYY and present William Penn's Welcome Week, October 13th through 21st, celebrating 325 years since Penn's arrival. Details at ushistory.org/Penn.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the relationship between the Bush administration and some members of the military. And that has soured over the course of the Iraq War. A number of generals have publicly criticized the White House over its planning and policies for the war. We're looking at this complicated relationship between civilian leaders and the military commanders from previous wars to today. Our guests are Richard Cohn, who is a professor of history, peace, war, and defense at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, a former chief of history for the U.S. Air Force, and Lawrence Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. From 81 to 85, he was assistant secretary of defense in the Reagan administration. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Richard Cohn, you mentioned before the break that you felt as if President Bush really delegated a lot of the responsibility for this war to Donald Rumsfeld. But as the founders wrote and constructed this Constitution, giving the president the authority to be commander-in-chief, what did they have in mind?
Their basic purpose was to make certain that the military remained under civilian political control. They had in their mind that there would be administrative heads to the departments, as the British government had. So there was a sense that there would be a Secretary of War, a civilian leadership of a War Department or some military department. But they very clearly had in mind that the President would be responsible for the conduct of a war, for war making, and that the President should involve himself in that to the degree to make certain that America's goals and interests, and particularly its defenses, were seen to. And throughout history, or at least beginning with the Mexican War in the 1840s, American presidents have tended to be hands-on leaders during wartime. You certainly could see that in the 19th and 20th centuries. There was much greater delegation, I think, after World War II, when the United States was in a Cold War and had to worry about kind of worldwide security interests all around the globe, but nonetheless, the responsibility rests in the Oval Office.
Let me get your response to that, Lawrence Korb. Even from your years in the Reagan administration, how did you see this balance of powers play out?
Well, I think when I worked there, the president and my boss, Secretary Weinberg, were very deferential to military experience in terms of, you know, making decisions. The interesting thing, I mean, sort of the Weinberger doctrine was the reverse of the Rumsfeld doctrine. And these operations obviously were not of the same scope, but when in the Reagan administration we went into Grenada, Secretary Weinberger took the number of troops that the military had recommended and doubled it. And his feeling was, you know, that, and whereas Rumsfeld seems, you know, the indication was they asked for 380,000, he kind of cut it in half. So I think they were, you know, they were much more willing to defer to military expertise than, you know, Secretary Rumsfeld seems to be. And, of course, that's, you shouldn't necessarily do that. I mean, because obviously the military comes with a narrow but important perspective, and it doesn't mean you have to follow exactly what they say. But I do think you have to strike that balance when you start getting into operational details, for example, then you can, you know, overstep your boundaries. And from the public, you know, from what we know, the books that have been written about Iraq, you know, the fiasco by Tom Ricks and Cobra II by Michael Gordon and General Traynor, it appears that Rumsfeld seems to have overstepped that boundary.
And would you agree with that, Richard Cohn?
I would. I perhaps don't see as clear a boundary as Larry might. I think the civilians have a very grave responsibility to oversee almost everything, to make certain that everything is done operationally and sometimes even tactically are in harmony with the policy and the strategy. But there's no question that they have to listen and respect military experience and military judgment and give it the closest thought. But they have to probe, they have to question. Because most military leaders they rise up at various stages, and they've never done a particular mission at that level before. They may have been in combat, but that might have been as a junior or mid-grade officer. So to some extent, it's different than any other profession. You know, a physician does from the very beginning practice his or her profession, but a military person, it's always different as they rise in responsibility.
And this may be more about current history, but it seems as if military people are more dovish than civilians when it comes to contemplating or planning for war. Is that true through history, or more apt for today, Richard Cohn?
Well, it varies, but I think they are always much more cautious and much more, I think, aware of the uncertainties of war and of combat, so they tend to try to avoid it at all costs. There've been bold and even irresponsible military leaders. One thinks of George Armstrong Custer or of other people who've wanted to gamble the dice, Douglas MacArthur. But by and large, they're reasonably and I think appropriately conservative. If not dovish, at least careful, cautious, and skeptical.
Let me turn to you, Lawrence Garb, then we'll get our callers in the conversation. And this has to do with the testimony that General Petraeus gave before Congress, talking about the surge, as it is called, the effect of the increased troops in Iraq. And on the one hand, President Bush said to Congress and the public that, you know, whatever Petraeus says, that's what we're going to believe, and that's really what the policy is. But if he's the commander-in-chief, is Petraeus getting his orders from the White House? And it seemed a bit of a hall of mirrors there, trying to figure out who was actually in charge of U.S. policy. Can you speak to that?
Well, I think that this was unfair to General Petraeus to put him in this position because, after all, yes, he is the commander, but obviously the president decides on the response of, on the policy. And the president, basically, because of his own low popularity, kept saying, well, I'll do whatever General Petraeus wants, and you, Congress, and you, the American people, have to support this policy, my policy, because you confirm, General Petraeus. So that put him in, I think, an almost impossible position. But I think General Petraeus himself is responsible for that, because back in 2004, right before the presidential election, when he was then in command of training the Iraqi forces, he wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post that talked about not only how well the training was going, but how well the war was going. And to me, that was inappropriate for a general to, interject himself into American politics. And there was never any, retribution or, concern about that. In fact, he ended up getting promoted. So I think I'm not happy with the way the administration has used him, or with, the way General Petraeus has acted prior to getting that command.
But are you saying that the White House has taken advantage of military deference?
I think they've taken advantage of the fact they've put General Petraeus in a position where if one disagrees with the president, it looks like you're disagreeing with a general. And that's not true. I mean, the general's supposed to carry out whatever the policy is, and one can say, this policy is wrong, but that doesn't mean you're unpatriotic. And, I mean, that's how that whole hearing went, that if you somehow criticize General Petraeus, in fact, that you were, being unpatriotic. I mean, he was carrying out the president's strategy, but they commingle the two, and to me that's a very bad precedent.
And we're talking about the complicated relationship between civilian leaders and military commanders from previous wars to today. Should military brass be vocal about their criticisms of civilian leadership? And we're talking about the proper balance between these two forces, certainly in times of war. And the voice you just heard is Lawrence Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Also with us, Richard Cohn, professor of history, peace, war, and defense at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Got a couple open lines here at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Should military leaders speak out if they are critical of U.S. military policy? Let me get Larry from Philadelphia to join us. Hi, Larry. Go ahead. Your radio times.
Hi. Yes. I thank you very much for your program, and
sure.
I'll take my answer off the air. I am very concerned, having been a historian for the military, for the Air Force, when I look at the kind of deference that is supposed to, that the military is supposed to give the civilian elected officials, that they are not living up to what especially these officials talk about in terms of supporting the troops. They have young men and women out there giving their lives, arms, legs, eyes, bodies to policies that are not being, where they are not directly benefiting from that sacrifice. And is it not the responsibility of the military leaders who are there seeing what is going on? They know exactly what is happening. They are right there. And they have the responsibility for taking care of these troops, to speak out, not in back rooms, not quietly, but loudly,
well, Larry,
as some of these generals have done.
Well, I appreciate your call and the passion on the issue as well. Let me get a response from Richard Cohn. What do military leaders then owe the troops on the ground if there are problems with the policy?
I think the first thing they owe troops on the ground is to have spoken their minds very forcefully in private to their superiors. And second of all, they then owe their troops on the ground the very best leadership that they can provide once the decisions are made. But the consequences of them speaking out and the consequences of them opposing the policy publicly would be to completely upset the system of civilian control of the military we have in this country. It would undermine American democracy. It would, in effect, give the war-making power to the military. It would give the military control over policy. That's not our Constitution, nor is it our tradition. And while the American people might say to themselves, yeah, the military should be the ones to determine these things, they also have to ask themselves, you know, do we like the Constitution? Do we like our system of government? Or let's just this one time not follow it and see how that goes. As one officer quoted in the paper said, I don't think so.
Well, let me find out what Lawrence Korb thinks about that. Lawrence Korb, go ahead.
Well, I think there are appropriate ways to do it. Let me give you an example of Major General John Batiste. He was in Iraq, and he was also Secretary Rumsfeld's military assistant. And then he was offered a command to go back and get a third star, and he turned it down. And I think that's the way to do it, because he obviously disagreed, you know, with the other Larry's, you know, concerns. I think he saw a lot of that, and he felt that, you know, he did not want to do that, put young men and young women's lives at risk for what looked like a failed policy. And I think that was the appropriate way to do it, and say, look, I don't agree with this, and so I'm not going to take this command and go ahead and retire. I do think that they also have an obligation to speak their mind to Congress. I mean, if there's not enough equipment and things like that, I think they need to let Congress know. I mean, Congress was so concerned about the chiefs, the service chiefs, not speaking their mind in Vietnam, that they lengthened their tours from 2 to 4 years so they couldn't be fired, and the whole feeling was that, you know, that they could then be more honest with the Congress about these things, because we do need to know these things. But the one thing that, as I mentioned before, that does bother me and I think crosses the line, I don't want to see military leaders on Sunday morning talk shows. That's not their job. And this administration, I think, has used both chairmen of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to go on these shows and more or less assure the American people that things were going well when an objective analysis would show that they were not.
Larry, thanks for the call. Let me get David from Upper Dublin to join us. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for having me on. I think that the country is going down a very dangerous road in two ways. One is that when a general or any officer has retired, there should be no question that they're civilians again, and they have the right and the obligation to, in a democracy, to say what they think about the policy that they as they understand it. I mean, not to give away military secrets, but to really lay out what they know so that the public can make decisions about the rightness or wrongness of the policy. And secondly, as a sort of a corollary to that, I think that the other dangerous thing we're doing is we're elevating uniformed people like General Petraeus to a position where it's wrong to criticize them and they are kind of worshipped by the civilian authorities, for example, in Congress, both parties. In a totally inappropriate way. These are guys that work for us and work for Congress, and they're not any better or any worse because they wear the uniform. They don't have special wisdom that makes criticism of them inappropriate.
Two fair points, David. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me put the first one to you, Richard Cohn, that when a military leader retires, as David said, he has the freedom of speech, the right to express himself just like the rest of us civilians.
Well, he has the right, but he has no such obligation. And that right may, in fact, if it's exercised, undermine the military profession and its ability to serve the country. The American people then will not distinguish, and they don't, between the most senior retired people and the active duty people. And to create that cacophony of voices will make it almost impossible, it seems to me, for the administration in office to work closely with its military leaders on active duty. They'll begin to appoint military leaders not for their competence and experience and excellence and abilities, but they'll begin to appoint military leaders who can be certain to be quiet and loyal and careful. And if we begin to have a tradition in this country of the military intervening in the political realm, even after they're retired, we're going to go down a very dangerous path, the same kind of dangerous path the caller suggested with General Petraeus, and I agree with that part of it.
And let me find out what Lawrence Korb thinks. Lawrence, we're almost we have about a minute before our first break, but interested in your comments on David's call.
Well, I think, for example, General Zinni, before the war, when Vice President Cheney was talking about all the nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction there, and General Zinni had been the head of the Central Command up until 2000, and he knew that wasn't true. I think he was quite appropriate for him to make sure the American people understood that. I think, you know, Dick has a good point in terms of, retired military people. But again, in deference to Sanchez, the administration was blaming him as well as the Republicans. I mean, so if you don't want him to speak out, then you should respect his professionalism as well on the part of the politicians.
And that's Lawrence Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Also with us, Richard Cohn, professor of history, peace, war, and defense at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, talking about the numbers of generals and ranking officers who have spoken out against the Iraq war and have criticized the Bush administration. Is this criticism appropriate? And we are talking with our two guests about that and also taking phone calls here at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
JerseyArts.com supports WHYY with details on events including Bohème Opera New Jersey's production of Verdi's La Traviata. The story of one woman's struggle with love has been a classic for over 150 years. November 2nd at Princeton's Richardson Auditorium and November 4th at Trenton's Patriots Theater. Tickets at 609-581-7200 or BohèmeOpera.com. Bohème Opera New Jersey and more at JerseyArts.com.
This is the next to the last day of the fall membership drive here at WHYY, and we're looking for your pledge of support. Give us a call here at 1-888-345-9499. Become a member of the station that you listen to. And if we can get 800 listeners to make that call during this drive, the Independence Foundation will give WHYY an additional $10,000. We do want to take advantage of that very generous challenge. 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org, pledge online. Thanks so much.
Widener University supports WHYY. Widener has graduate programs in education, social work, business, engineering, and more. Widener is hosting a graduate open house on Thursday, October 18th on the main campus in Chester. To register, 1-888-WIDENER or widener.edu. Other programs available in nursing, physical therapy, hospitality management, and more. 1-888-WIDENER or online at widener.edu.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Last week, retired Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, former top American commander in Iraq, spoke out against the war in Iraq. He had harsh words for the Bush administration, and he's the latest in a string of military leaders who have criticized the policies and strategies of Iraq. This is not the first time there's been conflict and disagreement between the civilian and military leadership. And today in Radio Times, talking about some of the tensions and balance of powers between military and civilian leaders in times of war, our guests Richard Cohn and Lawrence Korb. Let's get back to our callers, and we've got Jim from Willingboro joining us. Hi, Jim. Go ahead, your Radio Times.
Yes, hi. My question, a military officer, a general who happens to still be in uniform, he's still under the orders of a civilian commander, if he sees something that's going terribly, terribly wrong and he complains about it to Congress or to the media or whatever, doesn't he become, in effect, a whistleblower? This has to be in a general's mind that he is still under orders, and we know what happens to whistleblowers. Something was said earlier. If you have a complaint regarding Rumsfeld and you go around Rumsfeld and take it to the president, well, where have you really gone? So I'll take my answer off the air. What protection do these people have that are still in uniform that see things going down the wrong path?
It's a good question, Jim. Thanks for the call. Lawrence Korb, you want to take that?
Well, there are whistleblower protections in the law, unfortunately, and many times they're not enforced. I mean, we've got examples all throughout the government now. For example, is one person who's complained about the contracting abuses in Iraq, and as I understand it, the government has not backed her up, and this woman, you know, whose job is in jeopardy, and we do have laws to protect them. Again, to go back to Jim's point, just depends on what you're talking about. In other words, if the president was ordering torture or something that violated the Geneva Conventions, and I think the military person has the right to speak out on that. And then the third thing is with Congress. If Congress asks them, I think he has to he or she has to be honest with the Congress. But I don't think if they disagree with the strategy or something that for example negotiating with Iran, for example, if the president should decide that. That's something they should, be speaking out publicly on.
And to you, Richard Cohn, I mean, let's say you do have an out-of-control civilian leadership. What responsibilities would military leadership have to deal with that, if any?
Well, the military, of course, has an inspector general system. When they see malfeasance, they can, down in their services, they can go to their inspector generals. Second of all, they do not, and they are not supposed to carry out illegal orders. But I think Larry's right. When they have a disagreement over strategy and policy, they really have no recourse, nor should they. Their function is to advise the policymakers in this country and then to execute lawful orders. They need to speak up, and they need to speak up candidly to try to prevent problems. And I think that civilian leaders, the President, Secretary of Defense, know that they are going to be held to account by Congress. and these military leaders are going to testify before Congress. The problem with the Iraq War was that you had a supine Republican Congress that wouldn't hold hearings and wouldn't bring these people before them and wouldn't investigate. So when you have that peculiar situation, there's almost no recourse to disagreements in policy or strategy.
Did the founders fear a military coup d'etat? Is that why they spread these authorities across the various branches of government?
Well, yes, that's why they divided authority over the military between the executive and the legislative, and also the military is subject to law from the judiciary. But most of all, they simply did not want military officers, generals who become heroes in wartime very frequently, to have the political ability or the authority or the power to essentially begin calling shots from a policy standpoint. It's not their role.
Let me get to Greg from Chemung, New Jersey, to join us. Hi, Greg. Go ahead, your Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
I've heard a lot of people talking about the importance of the generals not doing what civilian leadership says. That is, we're concerned about their rebellion against the civilian leadership. But looking downward from the general position, imagine a general who publicly has said he's against a particular campaign, you know, not necessarily a policy, but so much as a military campaign, opposing something that's being done in the field. Imagine the effect that's going to have on the troops. There are people who are putting their lives at risk, and all of a sudden they find out that their commander is against the idea of what it is they're doing right now, and I think that could lead to chaos. I think there's a real important reason in terms of military discipline and getting the troops to do what they're supposed to do, to not have generals speaking publicly against campaigns or strategies or tactics as well as policy.
I think it's an interesting point, Greg. Let me see what Lawrence Korb says to that.
Well,
Larry,
again,
ahead.
It depends on what happens. I mean, if the Congress, you know, is asking the commander in the field, you know, what do you think and what's the situation, you've got to be honest with them. But I think it's very important to keep in mind the troops know what's going on. And what I think is fascinating about the debate recently, we've had all the generals, and they've been telling us things are going great many times. But you had those 12 enlisted people from the 82nd Airborne, you know, talk about the conditions on the ground. And then you had the seven Army captains this week in the Washington Post. And you read them, they know what's happening. So I understand there is this line, you have to be somewhat careful. But don't underestimate the quality of the people. I can remember my own experience in the 60s when I was in Vietnam. You know, we knew what was happening there, and so we were not, if you will, demoralized when, you know, people would say, hey, this is not going as well as we thought.
Let me see what Richard Cohn has to say, then we'll get back to our callers. Dick Cohn, go ahead.
Well, I agree, and in this age of email and wide distribution of media, they definitely know what's going on. I think the caller makes a very good point. One of the functions of a military officer, and the higher the commander, the more the responsibility falls on them, is to take difficult orders or ambiguous orders or problem situations to the troops and motivate them to perform. If they don't perform well in battle, they put themselves at risk as well as the nation. Military leadership and the military profession is a very special form of responsibility and authority. Lives are at stake and the life of the nation. So they're put in that squeeze. That's what comes with high rank.
Let me get Bob from, I think it's Phoenicia, New York, to join us. Hi, Bob. Go ahead, your Radio Times.
You pronounced it correctly.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Wasn't sure about that. Go ahead, Bob.
Just wanted to buttress the comment that hadn't been made when I made my call about the role of Congress in this. Up until 2006, there really was absolutely no place for the military to go because the Congress just sat there like a drunken Greek chorus, mouthing whatever the president told them to mouth. And, you know, had these generals or had any critics gone to them, they would have been vilified and probably had their characters assassinated just the way any other critic of this administration has. It's a really seriously flawed situation, and one that gives a whole spectrum of negative possibilities about the future of our country and our Constitution. These guys just didn't have the courage and didn't have the ability to hold any hearings that were meaningful.
Let me get Bob. No, I appreciate the call to the show. Let me get Richard Cohn just to respond to that. Go ahead.
Well, I tend to agree with it, but I think we have to remember that many military leaders, I think, bought the idea that this would be easy, quick, and cheap, which is the way it was sold to the American people. And I've talked to senior military leaders who believed in the policy and strategy, thought it could be done, would admit their mistakes about planning for the aftermath and perhaps the people put in charge, but believe that the war in Iraq was not going really as poorly as we think now until the attack on the Golden Mosque in Samarra in February of 2006. I don't altogether agree with that. I think it was not going well from nearly the beginning because we weren't prepared for an occupation, didn't have enough troops, and didn't pursue the right policies. But the caller's right. The Constitution's not perfect. It creaks occasionally. And when you had that situation and an effective administration that wanted this war no matter what and would, corrupt the facts in a sense to make the sale to the American people, you have a problem like this.
You know, Lawrence Grubb, I don't know if you saw much of Ken Burns' series, The War. I watched the first half of it, struck by many things, but one were just all the strategic, tactical mistakes that were made early on in the war, especially in the Pacific theater. And I wonder, since we're talking about this, you know, balance of power between military and civilian leaders and what happens when in the middle or the beginning of a war when there are problems and mistakes.
Well, yeah, there certainly are, and I think we're certainly concerned with this administration maybe not allowing the military to play its proper role or giving proper deference to it. The fact of the matter is the generals and the admirals are not always right either, and that's why we have elections and, you know, political leaders have to make a judgment because they're hearing not only from the generals, but you've got diplomats and you've got intelligence people, and they have to weigh all of those facts and then make a judgment. And we tend to forget, because World War II turned out so well, the various mistakes that were made along. And you just got Rick Atkinson has come out with a new book about all the horrible things that happened in the invasion of Italy. That again, we sort of glossed over, you know, because the Normandy invasion followed so quickly after it.
Absolutely right.
Go ahead, Richard.
No, I just wanted to second Larry's comments.
And that's Richard Cohn. He's professor of history, peace, war, and defense at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Former chief of history for the U.S. Air Force. Also with us, Lawrence Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Before joining the center, he was senior fellow and director of national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And back in the 1980s, from 81 to 85, he was assistant secretary of defense in the Reagan administration. And talking about this balance of powers between civilian and military leadership in times of war. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Radio Times.
And thank you, Marty. I am Susan Greenbaum, one of the producers of Radio Times, here with Kara Burke, who works here with me at WHYY, here to remind you that indeed we are in the final days of our October membership drive, hoping you will take a moment to call us, become a member, 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. And Kara, you know that we are in the throes of a situation here. The Independence Foundation has generously offered to give WHYY $10,000 if we hear from 800 listeners between the start of our drive, which was Monday, and the end of our drive tomorrow. Now, we need to hear from 800 Radio Times listeners by midday tomorrow. We have already heard from a little over 200, and during the next hour and 15 minutes or so, we need to hear from an additional 220 listeners of Radio Times who call in and become members in order to maintain to stay on track to reach that goal of 800 tomorrow.
Oh, there's one.
So please do give us a call, 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. If you pledge, we can make your dollars go a little bit further by adding to it with this Independence Foundation.
Right. It's a wonderful opportunity
grant.
For you to make your membership dollars go even further, Susan. Independence Foundation has offered to add to their contribution $10,000 if we get these calls in by the end
800.
Of the week. 800 calls. It's a
double
lot of calls,
duty
but
here.
I think we can do it.
We can do it.
I do. We have a lot of great fans out there, especially during our radio times, 2 hours every day from 10 to noon. Radio call-in show, locally produced. And it's a show like none other really here on WHYY. It's one of my favorites.
Well, thank you.
And Susan, you do a great job
well,
with it.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
That number to call again is 1-888-345-9499, 1-888-345-WHYY, or as always, online at WHYY.org. Now, we always like to give a little bit extra when you call in with your membership support. Basic membership, don't forget, starts at $50, which is really not a huge amount. I think it's pretty doable. If you want to give a little bit extra, we'll give you back a little bit extra in addition to all the wonderful programs that you enjoy every day. For a donation of just $180, we have a really cool combination here for you today. It's something that I know that I'm interested in. It's our outdoor travel combo.
Ooh, what is it?
It's the National Geographic magazine
Ooh.
For 1 year.
Yeah.
Our WHYY umbrella, this big blue and white. You can't miss it when you see it walking down the street. And you know we get a lot of rain here in Philadelphia, so it's always good to have that umbrella handy. And our WHYY tote bag, which is one of my personal favorite items. I talk about it all the time. Maybe you heard me before talking
that's
about my
tote bag. Yes.
It is. It zippers on top. It fits an unbelievable amount in there. So that's
just for $180, which is $15 a month. So we'll send you a year subscription to National Geographic, mm-hmm. An umbrella, WHYY umbrella.
And a tote bag.
Can't beat it. 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Today on Radio Times, it's another good example of the brilliance of Marty Moskowitz, my boss. But actually, if you think about it, what she's done in Hour 1, we've talked about a very complex issue, which really has its roots in the Constitution, military history, and that is the relationship between the military and our civilian leadership, which certainly has been stretched and challenged in recent years with increasing number of generals, retired generals talking out against the war, etc. Something we think that challenges you and the way you think about what's going on in our world today. In Hour 2, we're going to be talking with two local poets and musicians, Dave and Dan Simpson. They are involved in the upcoming Disability Arts Festival, and I'm not saying that name correct, and I will do it in the next hour. But they're here to talk about their creative work as musicians and poets, and they happen to be twins, and they're blind, and they're just terrific guys and very interesting.
Great story.
So that's sort of what we do. We switch from hard news, we switch to poetry,
it's a
to
great
authors,
contrast.
And we really have a fun time, hoping you appreciate what we do here each day on Radio Times, particularly what Marty does. That number to call is 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. And don't forget that we are in the throes of a challenge grant. Mm-hmm. Independence Foundation, Kara, as you mentioned, has offered to give us an additional $10,000 if we hear from 800 callers during this abbreviated fund drive. We've heard from a little over 200. Today we need to hear from 200 of you in the next hour. So please do help us leverage your pledge by...